This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we'll bring back our conversation with Andy Downs of the Mike Downs Center for Politics at Indiana Purdue Fort Wayne as he takes a look at some of the major issues that lawmakers will be facing when they trek to Indianapolis next month for the 2018 General Assembly session. We'll have stories for you from IU Northwest in Gary, as well as a former student of Purdue Northwest in Hammond and Westville. Interesting conversation there. You'll want to hear that. And also, too, we'll bring back our conversation with Indiana Youth Institute President and CEO Tammy Silverman, talking about a major support for a comprehensive counseling institute. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The 2018 General Assembly session gets underway on January 3rd, and we recently asked Indiana political scientist Andy Downs about some of the topics that will likely come up during this short 30-day legislative session.
There is anecdotal evidence about candidates, not just in Indiana, but across the entire country, who are signing up to run in primary elections, sometimes against incumbents, and sometimes just to provide a second option in the fall. We'll have to see how that all plays out before we get to Election Day. But at this point, it's starting to look like primary elections could end up being pretty exciting. Obviously, up your way with the announcement from Charlie Brown, I think you can expect a very exciting primary race there. Mm-hmm. But if you head down south and you go into the southern congressional districts, we have one that's actually somewhat hotly contested between Democrats trying to unseat Trey Hollingsworth. So we could have a very interesting-looking primary. At this point, there are a lot of people who are saying it's going to be active up and down the ballot, all over the place. You know, in the end, I think the reality will be a little less than that, but still more exciting than we usually see in primary elections, I think it's safe to say.
I know that certainly, and we've had some of your comments earlier about the U.S. senatorial race and how the Republicans are going to be, certainly if they haven't already, they will be going full force against Democrat incumbent Joe Donnelly. And certainly after the vote over the weekend in the Senate on the tax reform package, we have comments from both Senator Donnelly as well as Senator Young, their feelings about the measure as it's shaped up. And of course, it's now gone on to conference committee. It'll be reconciled with the version that's come out of the House of Representatives. And I'm sure that this is going to mean even more debate and certainly more comments that will be made from both sides, I guess, about it.
Yeah, and what will be interesting is actually to see how that plays out in the Republican primary. I mean, it will be significant by the time we get to November of 2018 as well. Mm-hmm. But in the Republican primary, I think we need to keep in mind that everybody talks about the two front runners as Messer and Rokita. But we have Mike Braun, who's running a bunch of television commercials, and some other folks in that race. It could be that in the primary, the vote for the budget will actually be viewed as a bad thing because of what some are considering to be the addition of too much debt. So we'll have to wait and see how that plays out, but it certainly is going to make things interesting in both May and in November.
Let's get back to the General Assembly issues, and there are a number of them I'm sure that will come up here. We know that at least now one that's certainly not on anybody's real radar right now is one that I'm sure that, that State Representative Charlie Brown has already said he's going to bring back. He's going to try to see if we can revisit the statewide smoking ban that was approved with the exceptions that were tacked onto it during the final debate. He wasn't happy, certainly, about it. I know that he's already said that this was one of the things he wants to try to see accomplished before he finishes up. And with this is last General Assembly session coming up, is to see some changes made. But there's some other issues we know, too, that are likely to come up, and certainly a lot of problems that the legislature has addressed and is going to have to address. And I know one of them in particular is going to be the opioid crisis.
There is. And if we can go back to smoking for just a second,
sure. Mm-hmm.
Just think about how recently the idea of a smoking ban anywhere was just unthinkable. It's really not been that long. You know, it's 10, 15 years, maybe 20 years in some localities. But we're really looking at a definite shift in people's understanding of where it's okay to smoke and not smoke, and even some bars and restaurants that are choosing to somewhat voluntarily segregate smokers from non-smokers so that the air is a little bit clearer. So, you know, who knows? Maybe this will be the year in which something substantial can be done there. As far as opioids are concerned, this is interesting because just about everybody says this is a major problem. But just last week, the state sent signals that said no more money going to programs regarding opioids. Mm-hmm. And that obviously is significant because for a lot of communities, they don't have an existing program or their program is overtaxed. So we get to see how that plays out. That could just be sort of a bargaining position with folks recognizing there will be a need for additional funds. And then again, maybe there are some folks who are hoping that federal money will flow through and help help out that way.
It could be, yeah, but with what the Trump administration has already said that it wants to do in the months ahead on the issue of opioids, the problem on a national level, to be sure. When going from controlled substances and the like being abused to alcohol. And we know that that's been, of course, a big issue, not related, but we know that a study commission has come out with some information. And at least recently, they've even talked about the possibility we might get to see some Sunday sales of alcohol, although not exactly as much as what some people have been pushing for.
Right. I've been telling folks for years who walk up to me and say, well, this whole thing is just ridiculous. Why doesn't the legislature do something? I've always said, as long as the legislature is only hearing from lobbyists, people with a healthy interest in the issue, they're going to find plenty of reason to either support or oppose Sunday sales and cold sales in certain locations. It's when the people start speaking out that the legislators will finally decide to move in a particular direction. And I think some of those interest groups are starting to recognize shifts in understanding or positions within the community. And so they are now trying to figure out how to negotiate something that is not as damaging to them as opening up the barn completely, but, you know, still moves a little, quote, forward, some would say. Others would say not so much further forward, but moves us a little bit forward while still maintaining some of the control that those interest groups currently have.
Are we likely to see any real education-related issues come up this time? We know last session and before we've had other issues, and some of it, of course, dealing with the situation in the community of Gary and to a lesser extent in Muncie, where we've had school districts that have had problems. Are we likely to see any issues involving school districts or at least the new iLearn testing system come up?
Yeah, I think there are a number of issues there. iLearn clearly will come up again because we're not set to do that yet, so that will come back up. I think that the high school graduation requirements are going to come up in one way or another. I think the recent report on a national level that pointed out the performance of charter schools will cause us to revisit that. There's a court ruling recently about Goshen College not being able to be a sponsoring school for charter schools, a sponsoring entity for charter schools. So there is plenty of reason to think that we will see quite a bit of education legislation, or at least conversations about it. And there's one that a lot of people probably aren't thinking about, and that's actually the size of districts.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember back to the Kernan Shepherd report from a number of years ago, back when Governor Daniels was governor instead of president of Purdue University, that commission actually suggested restructuring or consolidating school districts, smaller school districts, into larger ones, in part because of economies of scale. And while there were some small school districts that were able to say, hey, by most financial measures, we're better than virtually every other large school district, why are you making us fold in with another? The answer typically was, you are the exception. There are economies of scale that can be achieved if we consolidate school districts. But for people who've been around for a considerable amount of time, they'll remember when we tried doing this back in the 1950s, some of it was done, but it's painful because people have deep attraction and connection to their school districts.
And we were already going through that now in a different sense with the Gary Community Schools. They have too many schools and not enough students, and they have to take a look at that. That's one of the issues along with the financial issues that the school district is going through right now.
Yeah, exactly. So you look at a place like Gary or Indianapolis where they're actually closing schools down. Muncie did this not too long ago. They're actually having to close schools down. And so that, you know, the attachment that people have to their school district, even within district, people have attachment to their high school. And so the argument about which one gets closed becomes very personal.
We're talking with Andy Downs, who's executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Politics in Fort Wayne, and talking about some of the issues coming up with the General Assembly session in the weeks ahead. And getting back to taking a look at making some changes, we talked about school district size. And I know that there's a possibility, I don't know how much of a possibility it will be, that redistricting is going to come back up for the lawmakers to consider this time around, I understand.
Yeah, it certainly will. There have been hearings. There have been not only hearings by the legislature, but community groups also sponsoring hearings around the state. This is getting a lot of attention at the national level because of a Supreme Court case that's moving its way through the system right now, or a court case that's moving its way through the Supreme Court right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to come up. The question is whether or not any action is taken or when any substantial action is taken. What a lot of people are pushing for is an independent, quote-unquote, independent commission to draw the maps in Indiana. But in Indiana, the legislature still has to play a role in it, according to the Constitution. So, you know, it would be possible that this body could draw a map, and then the legislature would be allowed to tweak it in some way, shape, or form. But this is tough because whoever is in power, since they get to draw the maps, they don't necessarily want to give that power up. That results quite often in maps that favor one party or the other, and that's what people are trying to minimize. By law, all that has to happen is the districts are equal in population, they're as compact as possible, and that there's a border, a contiguous border that goes all the way around the outside of it. But what a lot of people focus on is the need for competitiveness. The moment you have districts that are more competitive, you get more exciting elections, you get more involvement from people, and they say that's really what redistricting should be about. Unfortunately for them, that's not really what the law is about, although the Supreme Court case that's moving through might change that.
I understand, Andy, that there's some talk that maybe we'll see some national-related issues come up at some point in the General Assembly session. Do you think that we're likely to see something, for example, along the lines of the concern about hate crimes and even about carry arms without a permit? Are they likely to come to a statewide level anytime this session?
I think both of those. I think you could also probably throw in their health care to some degree. You know,
yep.
We're still waiting. The state's waiting to hear from the feds regarding HIP 2.0 right now. But the carry issue, there is a movement afoot to actually have reciprocity between states. So if you have a concealed carry permit in one state, you automatically have it in another. There will be states that will react to that either by embracing it or trying to protect themselves from it, as the way some people would probably word it. I think that's certainly possible. And, you know, the hate crime stuff, we've been seeing attempts at that for years and years and years here in Indiana, and it typically doesn't get very far. But with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and the fix, quote-unquote fix, that happened a couple of years ago,
yeah.
It's possible that things have maybe calmed down enough that that can surface as a discussion point again, as opposed to a reactionary debate. This could actually be an honest discussion. There were a number of communities around the state that considered their own local legislation. Some adopted, some didn't. And so maybe it's time for that kind of discussion to happen. But we have to keep in mind it's a short session, so they don't get the full 4 months to mess around. They've got to sort of limit what they're going to focus on.
Yeah, I know. Probably another issue too is the one that's the hot button issue right now is immigration, and we know even here in northern Indiana, there's a concern that has been voiced about the possibility that there might be some type of immigration prison facility set up, even as to us as close, and even to you as far as Fort Wayne's concerned, as close as Elkhart County, and that is one of the big issues that's being debated right now.
Yeah, I was talking with someone who's an attorney who does almost exclusively immigration and national naturalization legislation, and I said I asked her if things have gotten confusing, and she said no, in part because no laws have changed, but she did talk about how certain agencies are changing the way they're doing things. So these are administrative changes; these are not law changes in the actual law itself,
mm-hmm.
and that's causing confusion. So. You know, the law is the same, and there's some confusion about who's taking charge over what and how people are doing certain things. There are, of course, plenty of stories about changes in enforcement at the federal level, and then also stories about the feds insisting that local governments play a role different than perhaps the way they've played it before. I think it's a safe bet that there will be something introduced and some kind of a discussion, but, keep in mind, we introduce, or the legislature passes only 20 to 30% of all legislation that's introduced. That means an awful lot of stuff gets introduced and gets a first reading and maybe gets a hearing but doesn't make it any further. Immigration could fall into that category. We'll have to wait and see.
Okay. One last time we went to have a chance to talk about what's coming up here in the legislative session, Andy, is one other issue about business-related issues. We know that a lot of time was spent, of course, in the longer session last year to deal with the issues of infrastructure repairs, and that's, how the increase in the gasoline tax came about. There's an issue which even strikes home here in Northwest Indiana in particular. We're seeing the impact of what is happening with the big-box stores closing up, and they've gone and appealed the property tax assessments that have been levied on some of these communities, in particular the town of Merrillville, is facing that. They're going to be losing revenues because of a judge's decision that the tax assessment is too high, and in turn that's going to be less revenues and property taxes, in particular in Merrillville, that they're facing here. Is that likely to be an issue that will come up before the lawmakers this next session?
In part because that case is actually working its way through the system. Mm-hmm. The legislature often says, well, let's leave it alone until the legislature, or until the judicial branch is done. They sometimes take that hands-off approach. However, we're talking about a pretty significant financial issue for a lot of communities, whether it's Merrillville, I mean, we have some here in Fort Wayne. Virtually everybody has one of these things. And so, you know, the tax caps have hurt local governments quite a bit in terms of revenue getting cut off because of the caps. This would be just another hit on top of basically close to a decade now of revenue hits. I could see some legislators being sympathetic to local governments and wanting to help them find a way to deal with this. But at the same time, boy, those tax caps were awfully popular, and local governments still have at their disposal the ability to implement and increase income tax. It could be that the legislature says, you know what, the court's dealing with that issue, and you have within your power income tax and other taxes, wheel tax, et cetera. Figure it out yourself. We're not going to pass any laws regarding property tax right now.
Andy Downs is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at IU-Purdue Fort Wayne. This is Regionally Speaking. It comes to you Mondays through Thursdays here on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Indiana University Northwest Center for Urban and Regional Excellence is once again offering a series of classes beginning January 5th that they call Senior University. Ellen Zarletta is the director's center. First, for people who are not familiar with IU Northwest Senior University, please tell us what it is.
Senior University is an opportunity for individuals who are age 55 and older to engage in learning experiences so that they can challenge themselves and dig a little deeper into some subjects, discover some new areas of interest, and make new connections with other community members.
Now, how many years has this been going on?
The university has been ongoing for over 15 years.
It seems like that you've had an opportunity to talk to a lot of people and get them acclimated to new thoughts, to new ideas, to new procedures. And so it's certainly not going to be a case where people are going to be, you know, certainly miss out on something that they probably should be attending these classes. If there's something in their lives that's changed or about to change, that's this way they're ready for it.
Absolutely. So we have a very wide range of subjects that we cover, everything from the email and internet to jazz history and ancient beer and wine. So there's a little bit of everything in our offerings, and we strive to be able to, you know, have classes that are of interest to everybody so we can serve all the members of our community.
Professor Carletta, let's go down the list and talk about each proposed class coming up here at Senior University starting in the first of the year.
Sure. So in January and February, we have our offerings that we are now currently advertising. And so the first offering that we have is on January 5th, and it is called Right Through Grief. This program is developed to help people who are in the process of overcoming grief, and they do this through the process of writing. So we have an excellent teacher who is going to share her life experience and also help others understand how writing can actually be a benefit to overcoming grief. If you're into physical activity, we have a chair yoga and aerobics class. We have found our seniors to be very engaged in this class. and there's no physical ability requirements. We make modifications for different abilities, but students have an opportunity to be more flexible, to learn how to become a little bit more stable, and also can exercise and achieve a little bit of cardiovascular fitness if that's the level at which they want to participate. If you want to learn more about the internet and email, in January and February, we also have an excellent instructor who's going to help individuals learn how to create email addresses and passwords and send and receive email, as well as become more familiar with the internet. So if you are interested in music, we have a history of the saxophone and jazz taught by Northwest Indiana's own Billy Foster. He is a legend in jazz, and probably many people are aware of all of his performance work and teaching. He's taught for us for a while and is really an engaging instructor. New course offering is Ancient Beer and Wine. I know that may seem like ancient art and beer and wine don't go together, but this instructor is going to help us understand how those two things do come together and explore a little bit about history and art and literature. And then for those people who want to learn more about how to take good care of themselves, we have a joint pain seminar as well, and that's in February. So that's a very busy 2-month period that we that we have, and we're looking forward to offering more classes in spring.
That's right, but it certainly seems that way. And in particular, when you're talking about the one class coming up here late January and early February about the history of the saxophone and jazz, and with Billy Foster teaching that one in particular, I'm sure he's had opportunities to play alongside people like Lester Young, certainly other people that he's probably known personally, like Dexter Gordon and maybe even Charlie Parker.
Yeah, you know, he has a very interesting history, and he's really willing to share that with people. So if you want to learn more about his work, of course, he also has a radio show, and he does do a bit of his own personal history when he teaches these classes that really provides a context for what he knows and how he knows it. And he has also on occasion, although not this time, has performed for us in our senior university program. So that may be an upcoming spring program.
That's right.
So you can actually see Billy in action.
And one other, the offerings, in fact, the first one you mentioned there to kind of start the list of offerings off here, the course on Right Through Grief. It comes certainly an appropriate time of year. People have gotten through the holiday season, perhaps trying to deal with a loss in the family or other personal issues that in turn something like this would certainly be a big help.
Yes, and you are so right, Chris, and that's one of the reasons why we put this in January at the beginning of the year, because we know that this can be a very difficult period of time when people get off of the holidays and they've experienced a personal loss. So we're really hoping that those who are in that position will take advantage of this opportunity. All these classes are free for seniors age 65 and over, so all they need to do is register with us. And if you know, one of the goals is to be of service to the community, and we think this will be of tremendous service.
Well, this is very appropriate that you should start out the offerings for the upcoming senior university at IU Northwest, talking about the pain of grief and the like, and closing it out with physical pain, talking about joint pains and problems like that, too. Now, let's go into the small print now, so to speak, here. If people are interested in any of the offerings, maybe all of the offerings, if they can manage to work it into their schedule, how can they find out more about the offerings, sign up, and how they can get over to campus to attend them?
Yeah, there's a dedicated number for our senior university program. They can call 219-980-6907. And if we're not available at the time, they should feel free to leave us their phone number. It's really important that they do so that we can call them back. Oftentimes we're on the line talking to other seniors. So 219-980-6907. Or if you already set up this email, we respond very quickly to email, and that is curesu@iun.edu. So curesu@iun.edu, and we will get back to you at our earliest convenience. We're happy to sign you up for more than one workshop.
Well, Ellen, thank you very much for talking about this, and I hope you have a great turnout for all of the courses coming up for senior university this spring.
Oh, thank you very much, Chris. We appreciate it.
Dr. Ellen Zarletta is the director of the Center for Urban and Regional Excellence at IU Northwest in Gary. When Jasmine Cervic decided to go into Purdue University Northwest to pursue a degree in business, she really never thought that it would kind of turn out to be a different journey that she has experienced over her career in college. Now that she's a graduate, she looks to the future in the workplace. And we happen to have Jasmine with us to talk about how life has been so far and her experiences in college and what she wants to do with her life, I guess, after college. Jasmine, thanks for being with us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you found life, at least going into college, was a little different from your life in Couts.
Well, going into college, I am a non-traditional student. So back when I was 26, I was already married and owned a home and everything. So going back into school was a little bit of a culture shock for me. Going back with kids that had just graduated from high school, I felt a little out of place. But I soon found that if I just jumped in and got involved, that it was a very welcoming place, and it was so much better once I got involved and interacted with my peers.
Now, I guess you've found your real passion, I guess, is in creative writing. Let me ask the question, what is your definition of creative writing?
Well, for me, creative writing is such a broad topic because it can be fiction, nonfiction, songwriting, poetry, anything that you find is a creative outlet for you, and you do that through writing, I think that's creative writing to me. So even if you find writing essays, you feel creative when you're writing essays, go for it. That's creative writing.
Mm-hmm. Now, we should mention, by the way, too, that you did get your bachelor's degree in management, and you just have a minor in creative writing, so it's not your top priority, I suppose, as far as your life work is concerned. But you found it important enough that you want to try to combine that together with whatever you're going to follow through with a business life there, too. How do you think that you can pull this all off, so you know, to be able to combine all this together?
Well, when I was looking to add a minor to my degree, one of the ones that stood out to me, it's creative and professional writing. So I did have to take a business writing course and a professional writing course. And I found that in previous positions that I've had, that writing was really lacking in a lot of candidates we have for other positions. So I wanted to really hone those skills. So I learned about grant writing and writing technical reports and things of that nature that can definitely be used every day in the business world. So it was a great combination to add to my management degree.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand, too, that you've added all of this together with a little experience, and now that goes into your writing experience in college, but also, I guess, following on as you know, your experience in life as well. And that's where I understand Professor of Biological Sciences Vanessa Quinn comes in. Tell us what Professor Quinn helped you do.
Well, so the first summer that I was in school, I took a hands-on biology course. We got to go to the Smoky Mountains for a week, and that counted as my science with a lab requirement for my degree. And her course really opened me up to talking to students outside of my major and really getting a hands-on learning experience that I would have never had otherwise. Mm-hmm. So that was where I kind of really started to talk to other people, because my first semester there, I just went to school and came home. I didn't interact with other students really unless I had to. So that really pushed me out of my comfort zone. And after that, there was no looking back for me.
We're talking with Jasmine Cervic from Couts, who is one of the recent graduates from Purdue University Northwest, taking her classes and getting her bachelor's degree in management, but a minor in creative writing. And you've told me here that you've been getting your work done, meet all your requirements for getting your bachelor's degree together. You had this a very long field trip to the Smoky Mountains. Do you think that maybe that as well not only helped you out biologically, so to speak, but it helped you out too in coming up with some ideas for creative writing?
It definitely helped me get in touch with a different side of myself, because I was never really a huge outdoor person in my adult life. So getting back to nature a little bit was great. We had to journal while we were down there. That was part of our assignment. So not only the scientific side, but we had to journal. And I think that was very cathartic down there, just being able to get back to nature and relax while learning tons of new stuff.
Tell us about not only the experiences that you had there in your class in the Smoky Mountains, but when you got back to campus, how you've been able to keep up your involvement up through the time that you've gotten your degree.
I had a lot of great professors that informed me of different leadership opportunities. So I got involved with our Business Leadership Society, which was great. I met some people that were also pursuing business degrees, but in other focuses. So I hadn't really met them before. So they had degrees in leadership or HR, and I got to meet them and get involved. And then through that, pushed me into another chapter, which was the Dean's Student Advisory Council.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just having great professors and having close relationships with them will help anyone get into, if they want to be involved. Your professors are great resources for that.
I understand that you've credited in particular one professor who's actually the former College of Business Assistant Dean, who's now Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs, Lori Feldman. How did Chancellor Feldman help you out?
Dr. Feldman was leading our Dean Student Advisory Council for the College of Business. So what that was, it was a group of student leaders from the College of Business that came together, and we were advocates for the students, kind of a go-between between the dean and the students. So if they had any issues, and we tried to just help make the College of Business a better place for students. And so she really cared about students' involvement and their thoughts and feelings on the College of Business. So it was really great to see her be so interactive with us, and so she was a great role model for me.
Mm-hmm. I guess she directed you into a lot of other activities on campus, too, that that helped out, I guess, got you towards the Honors Program and like, too, didn't she?
Yes, the Honors Program is a great thing. It's an Honors College now that they merged the two campuses.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to experience a lot of different events, meet a lot of different people from all different plans of study. I got to present at an undergraduate research conference, all kinds of things that I don't think I would have taken on otherwise had it not been for the Honors College.
Now, you already mentioned here that you've had the opportunity here of being very open-minded, being very involved, and you feel these are some of the ways, the truly keys to success. Are you going to be able to use these now that you've gotten your degree in hand and you go out there in the workplace?
I definitely hope so. You know, it's not just about what's on your resume and what's on paper, but it's about what you've experienced and what you've learned in other ways. I mean, obviously, we're there for the classes and the classroom and what you're learning there to get that degree. But I learned much more about myself and other people and leadership and management styles from these things that I was involved in. So from the clubs and meeting all kinds of new people, I think those are things sometimes that students overlook. They think that it's all about the piece of paper, but it's not just about that. It's about the overall experience.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jasmine, talking about now your family life with the family members to take care of as well, too. Back home now, you've gotten your degree, and how can you blend all this together, or you're going to hope to anyway?
Well, you know, I'm really lucky. I have a very supportive husband that has supported me this whole way. So right now, I'm hoping, you know, I'm starting the job search. This is my first Monday as a college graduate, so mm-hmm. after I get off the phone with you, I plan on jumping on the computer and getting to work, you know, updating my resume and cover letters and all of that fun stuff. So I hope that I can support him in the future if he wants to further his education.
Now, is there anything in particular, now that you have this opportunity, a whole world of opportunities, I guess, really, the things that you're interested in getting involved in now that you have this chance to be able to go out there and apply for them?
You know, I am really scouring job, you know, search engines like Indeed and LinkedIn and all that to try and mm-hmm. find the right fit for me. I'm really hoping I can work in my writing, something with communications. I'm looking every day at updated things. I want to stay here in the region for now, so I'm hoping that I can bring my strengths to a company here in the region.
Jasmine Cervic is from Couts, and she is now a graduate of Purdue University Northwest. She's gotten her main degree in business and actually in management with a minor in creative writing. And she's been with us to talk about her experiences that have gotten her so far to this point, that she's now a recent graduate from PNW and now out there in the workforce wanting to blend everything together that she's learned and all the experiences into something that will turn into a great career for her in the future. Jasmine, I'll let you get back to searching for jobs out there. Thank you very much for being with us to talk today.
Great. Thank you so much.
Oh, by the way, Jasmine finished her bachelor's degree in business and management in less than 4 years. The final curtain was Sunday evening at 6:15 at Star Plaza Theater after the Oak Ridge Boys performed a heartfelt rendition of Amazing Grace. The Oak Ridge Boys were chosen as the final act to grace the Star Plaza Theater stage, since the Grammy-winning group has the distinction of being the act to have played the venue in Merrillville the most since it opened in 1979. The theater will now be torn down to make way for a development.
The 3,400-seat theater offered what many call an intimate setting for local and national acts. From the yearly Christmas performances to big names like Willie Nelson and Chris Rock, the Star Plaza aimed to cater to a diverse audience. Hammond resident Nathan Forre says he has a lot of fond memories associated with shows at the theater.
I hate going to concerts where it's just like a little figure up on stage, basically not at all having a connection to the performer. That wasn't the case at Star Plaza. You always had a connection to the performer. So you always had a deeper meaning when you saw a show there.
But Forre says he understands that buildings grow old and don't last forever. Demolition for both the theater and the Radisson Star Plaza Hotel is expected to be completed by summer 2018, though a start date hasn't been set. White Lodging, the parent company for both properties, plans to build a new hotel in the vacant space that sits near the intersection of I-65 and US 30. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barb Anguiano.
State and legislative leaders shrug off concerns about recent tax revenue shortfalls, particularly with corporate tax collections. Indiana Public Broadcasting's State House reporter Brandon Smith reports that they say that the underwhelming revenues are the result of some rather explainable outside forces.
Total state tax revenues are about $150 million off the mark through 5 months of the fiscal year. That's almost entirely attributable to corporate tax collections, which have only raised about a third of what was projected. But House Speaker Brian Bosma says that's largely due to what he calls corporate tax planning.
Talked to some corporate leaders that have indicated they're postponing revenues until after the first of the year, with the hope that the federal government gets its act together and gives a dramatic tax cut at the corporate level.
Corporate entities have also received more than double the number of refunds so far this year compared to last year. The Indiana Democratic Party blames the shortfall on ongoing cuts to the state's corporate tax rate. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
State fiscal leaders will receive a new revenue forecast later today. Indiana Youth Institute President and CEO Tammy Silverman was on Regionally Speaking not long ago to talk about the success of the first year of the Lilly Endowment-funded Comprehensive Counseling Initiative. This $22 million investment is aimed at helping school districts and charter schools implement some rather innovative changes and to be able to deal with counselors' problems.
The challenge is, there simply isn't enough access to those school counselors. So, again, their board and their great wisdom came up with and made a large investment and issued this grant challenge to the state. And a lot of the school districts stepped up and put together some great proposals and were recently awarded those funds.
Now, I understand that the Lilly Endowment's intent was to help the school districts out that have been reporting back in and probably complaining for years about the fact that they are running into more and more problems with students, and they have too fewer counselors to help these students not only deal with maybe personal problems, but to be sure, deal with the problems they have that are causing problems in their educational process. And I know that the initiative that the Lilly Endowment has set up here was trying to help along and to help more people available. It could be counselors, training, and the like here too, but we know that when you look at Lake County in particular, there are several school districts that have received the grants. Tell us about the local ones and what they're being able to take advantage of through the Lilly Endowment program.
So the Hanover Community School Corporation was awarded a nice healthy grant of a little over $200,000. Lake Ridge New Tech Schools also received an award of $188,300, and then School City of East Chicago received $442,000. And so they all, you know, the great thing about this grant that I will say is that unlike some other initiatives, this one was wide open and it allowed the school districts to really take a look at themselves and say, what do our students need? And if that is an additional licensed counselor, great. If that is someone to take some of that administrative work off the plate of their existing counselors in order to free up more of their time, that works too. If it's more outreach to parents, that can go in there as well. So it really allowed each and every district to customize their request to hopefully best need the needs that popped up the most frequently from across the state were really those social and emotional challenges that our kids are facing.
Mm-hmm. Does it turn out that in your folks' discovery, when you were working with the Lilly Endowment on the plans for this initiative, that it was just a matter of, you know, as we said before, that there are too few counselors, and the counselors are so busy, they're not getting the time to be able to spend and help youngsters?
You're absolutely right. And the other thing is, different than teachers who obviously have a classroom schedule, the counselors are kind of viewed as, more flexible, right? So they were often asked to proctor tests. They're often asked to help with a lot of administrative duties. They're often asked to do all these things, which are obviously important to a school district, but yet aren't fully utilizing the training and the skills that these folks have. And so hopefully these grants will allow them to spend more time on some of these really complex issues that the students have. And we're talking about things like teamwork, stress management, self-control. Also, we're seeing more, obviously, peer cruelty is a term that came out kind of this, that it's not just the cyberbullying or the bullying, but it's really that lack of empathy that I think maybe back in my day we used to call citizenship, you know, that kind of an idea, as well as some of those big issues. Unfortunately, many of our schools in our state are struggling with teens who have contemplated or attempted to take their own life.
Do you think that maybe also in the case of the fact that the counselors didn't have time because of their duties that they had, not only to be able to be counselors, but also called on to help out in other ways in the school district, that maybe they ended up being substitute teachers, in some cases to fill in for staff that were sick or the like, and that in turn took them away from their counseling duties?
Well, and I'll tell you, yes, I think along the same lines as what we've heard from the schools. In fact, one counselor, again, a licensed, experienced counselor, was in charge of the school mascot. So rather than working with kids on suicide prevention or if they're being raised in a home where there's a parental drug addiction, those kinds of things, she literally was in charge of scheduling, the mascot, the Panther head, to make sure it gets to the football team on the football field at the right time. So obviously that is not the best use of her skills and abilities.
Important job, but somebody else could probably do it other than a counselor, I suppose. Yeah. In the op-ed piece that you made available to the statewide media, you talk about one school district in northern Indiana in particular, and they had some issues and how they have been able to take advantage of the Lilly Counseling Initiative to make some big changes, and they got the community involved, not just the school district and the teachers and the students.
In our work with the school district, we ended up doing a very large pool of surveys. So many of the districts wanted to actually reach out and talk to their staff, their parents, and their students. And one of the big takeaways from that is that both the teachers, the counselors, and the parents both want more engagement. And that was interesting. They're just having challenges making those connections. So one school district already kicked off an engagement and an empathy initiative. And so with that, their community foundation immediately stepped up and said, this is exciting stuff that's going on, and we want to be part of it. So we've seen that throughout the state, that many of the schools, just even having this conversation and the first planning phase of this grant, helped them to create some new pathways, some new initiatives, and most definitely new energy around the fact that these counselors can really make a big difference for our kids.
Now, in checking in with the education schools in Indiana, what do the teachers who teach the teachers have to say about these ideas that the Lilly Endowment Initiative has put out?
Well, and again, I don't want to pretend to speak on their behalf, but there were several universities that did also receive some funding so that they could, expand their programs as well. Ball State, UIndy, Oakland City University, Indiana University Southeast, Indiana Wesleyan. Each of those, because again, a lot of our teachers and counselors are dealing with monumentally complex issues, many of which weren't perhaps around, particularly dealing with kids who are growing up in an opioid addicted home or the high levels of suicide ideation that we have now. And it's great that they also, that the endowment backed it up and said, not only do we want to help the existing counselors, but let's help with the preparation of our up and coming counselors as well.
That is Tammy Silverman, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. The Indiana Toll Road Concession Company, which is the operator of the Indiana Toll Road, got together to talk with reporters about several projects that are aimed at making travel safer along the northern Indiana East-West Toll Road. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barb Bongiano tells us about it.
The ITRCC has focused on improving infrastructure on the toll road for the last few years. The company wants to now focus on road safety by using an intelligent transportation system, new technology such as full-color dynamic message boards, and cameras along 70 miles of fiber optic cable that line the toll road. Chief Operating Officer Rick Fetter says projects are implemented with motorists in mind. He says the ability to communicate with drivers about road conditions is important.
This is all geared towards road safety, the driving experience, and really pushing the Indiana Toll Road as a world-class asset that Northern Indiana and the state of Indiana should be very, very proud of.
Fetter says the new technology could even be life-saving because it's meant to help Indiana State Police locate and get to accidents quicker. The ITRCC will focus on infrastructure on the eastern part of the toll road in the years to come. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barb Bongiano.
And now time for another edition of Eye on the Arts with John Kane.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts are Dawn Diamantopoulos and Jethro Smith, who are with Dave. And we're going to find out all about Dave in the next few minutes. Dawn, I know as an artist who teaches for South Shore Arts at various locations. And Jethro, are you an artist as well?
Actually becoming an artist. I've been influenced by all the artists I've had to work with.
Okay. Well, let's find out what Dave is. What does it stand for?
Dave is the Dyer Arts Visionaries, and we are a group of artists and art enthusiasts that are regional. We're not all from Dyer, and just supporting the arts and bringing the arts out into the community, hopefully to let them see art and so that they will want it in their home and be more appreciative of it.
Are you? So you're a nonprofit. You've organized as a nonprofit.
Yes, we are.
And you're both board members.
Correct.
And you, so are you, you're headquartered in Dyer, I take it?
Yes.
And are you actually conducting programs in Dyer?
Yes, we are. Do you want to talk about that, Jethro?
Well, yes, we have. We've done a number of programs. We meet every day, every first Tuesday of the month at 8 o'clock at night in the lower level, the Glenn Eberle Museum, which is the Historical Society at the Town Hall in Dyer. We recently finished a program at the Dyer-Schererville Lake County Library. We wanted to have the public, kids, adults, come out and help us decorate Christmas ornaments, which are on our tree, which is at the Performing Arts Center in Munster for their Festival of Trees.
Ah, right. One of our
so we've done that. We have four businesses in Dyer that have art that people can purchase besides enjoying. We have it at Centier Bank, Foodies Restaurant. We have it at Intrigue, Day Spa and Salon, and my own office.
So you're very grassroots-ish.
Absolutely.
How, when did you organize?
Back in 2012, we started. And this was a something that was put together by Connie Trepton, who was on the council, and myself. I was on the Redevelopment Commission. We went to Paul Benninghoff, who was past president of the Historical Society and an artist. Paul got people like Dawn and Tony and other artists involved. And then in 2014, we became a 501c3.
That takes a little while sometimes.
You know, that's what's really great. The government has done something nice for us with the 1023 easy form. It wasn't that bad to do.
Oh, good. Good. Well, and you have a – Dawn, you said you have regional aspirations. You don't want to be just Dyer-centric necessarily. So, well, what are the goals of the of Dave?
Well, really to have as many exhibition opportunities for the artists regionally, but also to have the community involvement as well. Have them take part and see that art isn't scary and doesn't need to be something that they don't understand, that they can come to enjoy and appreciate as well.
So what? Give me an example of some of your programs.
We are just wrapping up three shows that we held concurrently. We had a theme of three shows across three venues in three towns. So we had beginning, middle, and end. The beginning show was at Wild Rose Brewery in Griffith, middle at Sip in Highland, and end at Paul Henry's in Hammond. And the end show will have a closing reception on January 13th from 2 to 5. And we'll be having an awards in Paul Henry's in
Hammond.
Oh, that's
at Paul Henry. Okay.
We'll be having the final award be given out that night, and we'll be announcing the theme for the next series of three shows because that was such a big hit. We had a lot of artists ask us to do it again.
People like to respond to theme challenges.
Right.
It's kind of fun. It sort of gets the creative juices flowing.
Right.
Well, so that's a good example of how Dave is not just Dyer-centric, but you're in three different communities for this project that aren't any, not a single one of them is Dyer.
Right.
Well, that's good. It's Dyer reaching out.
Yes.
That's fantastic across the region. Well, so what's coming up in 2018?
We are also going to be taking over Studio 659 in Whiting for their January exhibit, and that's going to be the Best of Dave. So we'll have it's a Dave members only exhibit.
Oh, that's fun.
And artists can join online and take part in that. And we're looking forward to showing off. We have an amazing array of artists that are part of Dave. And
how many members do you have?
We have about two dozen. So it's still a very small group, but very talented.
Well, I love all of these smaller endeavors that are cropping up throughout our region, and who knows where they'll go.
Right.
I think that they really have a huge potential for the future. And so good luck to you both and to Dave. I'm glad to know more about it. And I hope you have very happy holidays.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back with another edition of Eye on the Arts next week.
And that's host John Kane of Eye on the Arts, talking with Jethro Smith and Dawn Diamantopoulos of Dave as they discuss the beginning, middle, end. And you can hear this conversation again and previous editions of Eye on the Arts, by the way, on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And you can tune in next Monday here on Regionally Speaking at 5 minutes before 1 o'clock to hear another Eye on the Arts conversation. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow on the program, we'll have a conversation with the former mayor of Gary, Indiana, Scott King, who's now a busy attorney in Northwest Indiana. And we'll kind of reminisce about the days when Scott King was mayor of the Steel City. That and more coming up tomorrow on Regionally Speaking. Hope you can join us.